relationship of mutually responsive closeness, because it is very hard to be intimate alone. There is a need to relate. There is a need to share. There's a need for something coming back to you at the point of your own experience, that you find a need for responsiveness that someone is giving back to you. And therefore, intimacy is not a solitary relationship. Intimacy is a mutually shared closeness in which you feel that person is by you and you know that something is going on in your own experience in life. Intimacy with God certainly can be in a solitary way. Intimacy with persons as social beings is bound up in others being somehow close to you and you giving yourself in some way in closeness to them. It is a closeness that is experienced in a developing relationship, because intimacy is that which grows. It is not a stagnant entity of life. It is not something you discover and grasp and hold on to, but intimacy is experienced in a developing kind of relationship. It has the potential for growth, and therefore we are challenged to keep on exploring the new ways within which our lives might be related in intimacy. And that kind of sharing is based on a trusting acceptance of each other. You have to trust somebody in order to let your real self come through. You have to trust somebody to expose those feelings that are deeply inside, because you may be afraid of the person who can hurt you when you share your feelings. You may hold things in because even in your experience of growing up, there were times when you tried to share love and tried to give it and found that you were hurt in the experience of doing that. Now, that hurt is deeper than the kind of experience that you may have gone through when the breakup came of that very close dating relationship with a boyfriend or girlfriend in high school or junior high school or somewhere along the way. Those things happen and they hurt for a while, but they don't leave the scars usually that the deeply basic hurt when searching for intimacy and being rebuffed happens to you. When I was in high school, there was a girl, Elsie, who lived on the corner, and her boyfriend, who had been dating her for some time, had a pretty fair voice, had done some amateur singing on the radio, and he and Elsie were deeply in love. But the time finally came when Elsie put him back in circulation. And in that experience, he came riding by her house on his bicycle, singing, "I'll never smile again until I smile at you." About 2 weeks later, though, he was smiling broadly, and it wasn't Elsie. So the experience of some kinds of breakups do not leave their mark forever. But if you have tried to let your real self come through and found that you got rebuffed, it may have caused you to build a little barrier around that heart, and you may say, nobody else is ever going to get that close where I can get hurt again. Even in marriages today, there are those who live with that little barrier that keeps closeness from occurring. The trusting relationship is basic to intimacy. And so, as I think of the definition that we are talking tonight about a feeling, a mutually responsive kind of relationship, we're talking about a developing kind of setting, we're talking about trusting one another. Whether you are in a friendship relationship or a marriage relationship, those same things hold true. But as we come to look at the minister's home, student minister, pastor, educational director, when we look at the data that is so far available on studies in the home of those in ministry, we find there is a hunger for intimacy in the home of Christian workers. You may have seen the study done by David Mace, a study, by the way, dedicated to the Silers, based on the study of ministers' homes. And as you read through the data, you find that the wives and the men alike were saying something about a desire for better closeness, a desire to feel more open, a desire to have needs met that grew out of their being with one another and wanting to relate in a better way. The studies that have been done at Gloriet and Ridgecrest in the conferences for the wives of ministers have reflected time and again. I did one in Gloriet in 1 year and one in Ridgecrest 1 year. In both cases, the strong affirmation of desire for a marital relationship in which there is a sense of intimacy and closeness that could grow, and often a sense of disappointment that was not being achieved in the relationship. And then in our own campus, we have had for several years, a experience that I began after coming back from Ridgecrest, where we have an annual conference for the wives of ministers of any nature in our community, student wives and the wives of ministers who are in churches, whatever their role is, trying to help them grapple with the needs that are theirs in being the wives of those in ministry. And here again, as they voiced and wrote down their needs and desires, that desire for greater closeness was there. And so I think it's fair to say that as you have come tonight, it is probably true in your life that you would like your marriage to have in it the quality of intimacy of which we are speaking. And you may already have a very good thing going. You may already have a closeness that is happening there, and you feel very good about what is happening for you. There are others who may not feel quite that comfortable about it. So let's look tonight at what are some of the ingredients that affect marital and family intimacy. Obviously, we cannot touch on all tonight, but I would like to mention some that I think are important as we look at the roles that you play in your home. One of these is the input of the personality factors that are part of what we are. For our homes and our families are affected by our own personal structures, our own personality makeup. One of the things that seems to be so vital is that ministers and their wives, or wives and their minister and their husbands who may not be in ministry, whatever it is, need to have a strong and healthy sense of self. Not in the self-centeredness way that so much of popular psychology has emphasized in our time, but a strong and healthy sense of who you are in Jesus Christ as a person, and that God is working His will out through you. In one conference for ministers and their wives in a marriage enrichment time, one wife said to the group as they were sharing their experience, "I have never in my life felt I was worth anything." It's very difficult to relate well to others if you feel that badly about yourself. And some of the things that have been picked up in conversations through the time of being here, even these few days, reflect the fact that sometimes it is the minister himself, sometimes the wife, who does not feel an adequate sense of personal worth in order to fulfill the task that is yours and also to fulfill well the relationships in which you find yourself in your family. It is highly important that in some way you grapple with the reality of who you are in feeling comfortable about the self that God is creating in you. Now, unfortunately, some of us have been reared in a religious tradition as Baptists that seem to say feeling good about yourself is wrong. Some of you have experienced retreats or activities where you were asked to name a certain number of things you like about yourself. We do this often in marriage enrichment retreats. Baptists have a terrible time with it. If you ask them to name 10 things they don't like, they don't have any problem because they can write them down in no time. But when you say name 3 things you really like about you, a lot of Baptists have a real problem because somehow they feel it's wrong to like who you are. And yet, when Paul is saying to us, or Jesus is saying to us in the New English Bible translation, that if you follow me, you discover your true self, then that selfhood is the one that God is working in you. I do not believe we ought to follow the theological insights of the old hymn that talks about worms such as I. Now, they've changed it in the more recent hymnals, but a lot of Baptists still think it's true. I don't think Jesus came to save worms. I think Jesus came to save people to discover a new selfhood and therefore to work with the concept of affirming what you are and who you are as a man or woman in your marriage relationship or in your work is important to it. Another factor in your personality is the willingness to risk being open. The willingness to risk being open. If you have already formed the habit of protecting yourself, you may not want to risk that. Some years ago, in a book entitled The Self in Pilgrimage, the author said, "The person who will not risk giving and receiving love will live and die in emptiness." And some of us are afraid to love. Some of us are afraid to open up. Some of us are afraid to risk being close, even to a wife or a husband or children, because of our fear somehow that if we really open up, we're going to get hurt by doing it. And so the challenge of being willing to risk openness. It is a risky thing to love one another deeply. And yet it's the only way to discover what the meaning of love is. John said there's no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear. But none of us really are perfect lovers, but all of us can grow in the willingness to risk and be open with one another at the places where we have hidden ourselves away. And you may say, what? Me? You mean I'm supposed to tell him or her those things that I've got hidden away? Why, he won't like me anymore. And our fear of being disliked may keep us from risking openness. But a third factor in our personality is the sensitivity to mutual need meeting. For the husband-wife relationship, those needs are in the area of emotional fulfillment and supportiveness, as we are tuned in to the feeling levels that happen between us as husband and wife. The emotional response patterns that we need to tune in on. The need meeting that comes in sexual relationships. As a husband and wife recognize the opportunity of celebrating their love in the sexual experiences that are there. And yet, at times, one or the other will say, it seems that's all my mate cares about is the sexual part and does not really care for me in other ways. And so the challenge of sexual need meeting that is open to growth by sharing your lives in that way. And the spiritual need meeting that you might together grow. One of the problems of being in the ministry is that we feel so professionally religious, it's sometimes hard for us to be spontaneously religious in our family life. That we somehow think we're putting on a front because we are in the professional ministry, rather than experiencing our home life in celebrating our faith as simply the need that we have for that renewal that comes by prayer together and sharing together. And so the challenge of mutual need meeting of husband and wife, parent, child, have also those needs. The need for acceptance of our children, letting them know that we really do care, we really love them, we really accept them, and we affirm who they are and what they're growing up in being. For that kind of acceptance is important to their ability to relate to someone else later in their own life. The need for respect from our kids, but do we give it to them in a way that they know we respect who they are in their growing up years? And certainly a need for guidance as parents give themselves to the task of giving appropriate guidance, as Paul talks about, of guiding them in the way of the Lord. And so there are personality things bound up in who we are and what we do with our selfhood in relationship to others in the family. But a second factor that is an ingredient is the factor of marriage and family style. Some of you are familiar with the book that I did called Equality and Submission in Marriage, in which there is an attempt to try to evaluate different styles of family life. Basically, the two models that are normally presented are the so-called traditional or hierarchical model of family style, in which the male is dominant and has final authority, in which the wife is emphasized as being submissive to her husband, and in which the children are responsible primarily to the father, but then secondarily to the mother who operates in the father's place. And that the model here is one of structure of hierarchy in which there's a male-dominant kind of relationship. This is a very popularly declared model around our society. And for some people, it is working quite well. There is respect shown for each other. Some are comfortable with it and are feeling good in it. But if that is the model adopted, and one or more of the participants in it does not feel that this is a comfortable place for me to be, then the style itself may become a problem to your relationship. It may be that a wife or a husband, either one is seeking to change, and one or the other does not want to change because, you may have been told, this is the only biblical Christian model. Well, I want to say to you, that's not true. Because the partnership or companionship model is just as biblical and just as Christian as the other can be in its implications. And so the challenge of a companionship type of marriage in which there is equality, acceptance between the husband and wife, and in which there is a mutual entering into decision-making, in which the children are understanding the roles that mother and dad play it to them in such a way that they are responsible completely to both, a different model of life than the traditional or hierarchical, but based upon Paul's teachings in Ephesians 5, that we have the chance of being mutually related to one another. Now, I'm not as concerned tonight as to which one you adopt if you're happy in it. My concern is that, unfortunately, we're caught in a time when too many people are saying, unless you do it the way I tell you, you don't have a Christian marriage. And that's not true. As long as your life and spirit is open to God's Spirit, and you are fulfilling the principles of life and relationship that the Scripture gives to us, then the styles may reflect differing models. You may find yourself traditional on some things and partnership on the other. Or you may find yourself somewhere in the middle between the two. But you have the chance to develop a model of relationship that both of you are comfortable in. I was doing a retreat with a group of ministers in central Missouri some years ago. All of the group there were young, except one couple who had been married for about 20 years. And in the initial times of the retreat, the wife in that couple was very clear about her acceptance of the role of submission to her husband and all of the things that went with that. And she felt very good about it. As the retreat went on, and she heard other young men talking about diapering the baby, washing the dishes, doing some of the laundry, cleaning the house, she began looking at her husband in the, but they do it. And I'm not sure we enriched their marriage. I think it probably tore it up. But the experience of recognizing the possibility of adaptability to a model that fits your need is part of what is involved. The marriage and family style may affect the way in which intimacy occurs within your relationship. The third general area of ingredients, the interpersonal relationship skills that you are developing. One of the interesting dynamics is that we who often have spent a good bit of our time studying how to help others become skillful find that we're not practicing our skills, that we are not doing what we tell others to do. In some way, it's not working as well for us. And then when they come and say, thank you for what you helped me to discover, we keep wondering up here, why doesn't it work for me if it's working for you? But the developing and implementing of our partnership skills and our interpersonal skills is part of creating intimacy. For example, one of these is in the fact of effective communication. Do you talk so much on the job that you don't talk at all at home? Do you come in emotionally wrung out in such a way that you don't want anybody to talk to you and you want just to get off by yourself? Now, some people do and need a transition time. Sometimes we need to recognize that. Some men come in from a job outside, or some women do, where they have given so much emotionally, they need a time of transition, not to be greeted at the door with questions and comments, but a time to get in and unwind. There was a young wife, a very attractive young wife, who was getting disturbed with her husband. When he'd come in from his job, which was a very high-pressure job emotionally, and she had been there at home and waiting for him to come, he wanted to go down in the basement where his stamp collection was and play with his stamps instead of her. And she got very upset about this until she began to see that what he really was using the stamp collection for was transition time. So she began getting a cup of coffee and sitting down with him, and he could go ahead and paste all those stamps and he wanted to. And when he'd finally gotten himself sort of unwound, then he was ready to play with her. And she was able to recognize that her waiting was his time of transition. You may need to discover yours as far as how to relate to the fact of being by yourselves and then being together and knowing what you need to do. It'll be different for different people. But the effective communication is that we build patterns of understanding by verbal, nonverbal, and symbolic ways of communicating with each other. And already it's become evident in some conversations that some of you are having the problem that some of the rest of us have had of actually building good communication patterns at home, even though we talk about them with other people. And so the challenge of sharing yourself, communication really is on several levels. I like to use a model of One level is on the fact level, where it's not so hard. In the Minnesota couples communication, sort of a level one kind of communication. Some of it is feeling communication, where we're trying to share our feelings and getting over into to stage four and so forth. But self-disclosure communication is the hardest of all, because that's the one where you have to trust enough to let yourself come through. The greatest chapter on communication in the Bible is the first chapter of the Gospel of John. We did not know God. He communicated himself in the flesh of Jesus Christ that we could see him. And in your home, communication is disclosing yourself. Another is the skill of conflict resolution. We could spend all night, of course, and some of you have been in the conferences on conflict resolution, about how to handle times of stress and conflict. You may have read David Mace's book, David and Vera's book, in which one chapter is titled, Don't Waste a Good Conflict. Don't waste a good conflict. Because they are pointing out that many times our real growth takes place in times of challenge and conflict, when we have to face the reality of difference and then grow through it. Now, you may have one of those homes where there's never any conflict. You know, it's always peace and sweet and kind and nice. But not many have that I've ever known, as far as the experience of ministry life. And so the challenge of being able to deal with our differences is part of that. Even this thing of trying to become one may be a conflict-laden experience. In Geneva's home church in Greensboro, North Carolina, one of the men came a few years ago and said, you know, my wife and I spent the first 5 years of our marriage trying to become one. The only problem was we couldn't decide which one to become. And so the experience of even building our oneness may create some conflict within our relationship. Another area of skill management or skill development is in money management. You may say, fine, give me some more so I can manage it, that's my real problem. And that can be true. But we need to recognize the amount of money is not always the problem, but the symbolic value of money may be the problem to what we're doing and how we handle it. And so the developing of skill in handling funds may be a part of the challenge of your intimacy at home. And the parent-child relationship may be another, that as you learn together to relate to your children. These are interpersonal skill areas that affect intimacy and closeness in our relationships. Now, these then are what I've called ingredients that affect intimacy. The matter of your personality and how you relate, the recognition of the challenge of marital and family style, the challenge of skill development. But now, what are some of the basic hindrances to intimacy? What are the things that stand in the way? Some have already been alluded to in a way, but let me point out very quickly four of these. One is the conflict with ministry demands, that in your home, the challenge of your ministry and your family may be an occasion for the breaking down of intimacy if you are continually struggling over that reality. Most all of us in the ministry have had to face the time trap challenge as we seek to deal with time, and unfortunately, sometimes we've allowed time to claim us. Some of you know the books of Reuel Howe, who wrote The Miracle of Dialogue, but he also wrote one on a different theme in which he indicated that in our concern for time, there are times in which we allow time to control us in such a way we do not have time to be. Time to reflect, time to become what we need to be. And your home may need that commitment of time that is there. As a pastor in Florida, it seemed best to us in our family to use Friday for our time for the family relationship. And commitments were made to that. In my own date book, that night was marked out in such a way that if someone asked, all I had to say was, I'm sorry, but I'm committed already for that time. Now, that's okay when it's something that somebody asks you to do you don't want to do. It's more difficult when somebody asks you to do something you'd like to do, and then to say, I already have a commitment, you know, invited to speak to that large group or whatever, and you have to say, no, I have a commitment already. There are two things that are difficult about it. One is that you that you have to turn it down when you'd like to do it, and the other is they get somebody else so easily to do it. And therefore, you're not as important as you really thought you were. So the experience of time and its management is one of the hindrances to intimacy in our relationship. Another that ties into that is the lack of time with each other growing out of the challenge of time management for your job. Just actually committing yourselves as husband and wife to renewing your experience. Sometimes parents get so caught up with the children, they lose one another. Sometimes the television grips us when we are home and we do not have time for one another. You see, you can be home physically and not be present emotionally. And so the challenge of really seeing each other, you really need sometimes to deal with the television. One wife in a conference said, you know, my husband comes home and we have supper, and then while I'm cleaning up the kitchen, he gets in to watch TV, and by the time I get there, he's all wrapped up in it, and we don't have any time to talk. How can I get him to talk to me? I said, wait till he's in the middle of his favorite TV program and turn off the television. He'll talk to you. Well, they were asking a different question, weren't they? You just can't get all the communication done during the commercials. You got to fix the popcorn. So the experience of dealing with relationships means you may have to turn it off. And, of course, some people are hooked in. It's like the fellow said to his wife, now the baseball season begins tomorrow. Is there anything you want to say to me before that? So the experience of dealing with the reality of time for one another is there. But another that affects us is unrealistic family expectations. Unrealistic family expectations. I spoke last year to the Maryland Pastors Conference on one theme of your home model or muddle. A lot of people feel like I'm just muddling through in my house and there's no modeling going on. And yet we recognize that we do model a home life. Now, my concern is that we do not let ourselves get caught in the idealistic trap that makes us believe we should be modeling something that isn't realistic for life. Ideals help us grow, but an ideal can beat you over the head if it's always telling you you're a failure. If you have been dealing realistically with family and knowing that conflict is real, knowing that as persons you have differences, knowing that you have to grow together, then you can deal with family life more realistically. But if you're carrying a model up here somewhere that's so perfect that nothing ever is out of place, then you're going to be continually frustrated about what's going on in your home. The challenge of dealing in realism with where families are is part of the challenge of coping with intimacy. And if you have the wrong model, then intimacy won't grow because you're always disappointed. You're always frustrated about what's happening. Another hindrance is unresolved anger. Paul uses different words for anger. You remember over in Ephesians 4, Paul said, be angry, but don't sin. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. And that's the passage that couples use when they say, we're never going to go to sleep mad. And that is a good philosophy. It'll make for some sleepless nights, but it's a good philosophy as far as how you're dealing with life. But over in Ephesians 6, he says to fathers, don't provoke your children to anger. Now, the words are different. Because one is the kind of anger you can get out there in the open and look at it and resolve it and have it resolved. The other is really the word for resentment. When unresolved anger toward your mate or family becomes internalized resentment, it becomes a cancer that destroys your relationships. And the only way to cure it is to consciously face the reality that is there and to learn how to resolve anger. David Mace said last year at the Christian Life Commission seminar in Orlando, Florida, that he has come to believe that unresolved anger is at the root of virtually every marital breakdown where intimacy fails because we have not learned how to get that stuff that we've been gunny-sacking along out of our minds, or we have been dumping it on our mate every time we get mad and not learning how to resolve anger. Unresolved anger will destroy intimacy. and needs to be faced realistically if it is happening in your home. Now, in the light of all this, then, very quickly, what can we say about growing an intimate family? And I'm just going to make statements, and then we will have time for discussion, and they're kind of ABCs, so if you want, you can follow them easily that way. One thing in growing an intimate family is to acknowledge your need to grow. Those in ministry are often hesitant to admit their need to grow. They encourage everybody else to, but they're hesitant about drawing on the resources that say, we're not what we ought to be, and let's get with it to find out how to become what we ought to be. In a marriage enrichment retreat, one Kansas pastor had not planned to come, but his wife had planned for him to come. And the experience was such that he had to make some cancellations, but he was there. And out of that one weekend of focus on their family, he was able to say, even a year later, our home life changed when we were willing to look at our need. Therefore, to acknowledge the need. Now, that may mean going home with a family and saying, what's going on? What do we need to do? To acknowledge a need. The second thing is part of that, be willing to hear what's happening. If you are going to try to find out what's going on, be ready to listen without defensiveness when you hear what's being said. Down in Little Rock at Pulaski Heights Church, I had families one evening get off by themselves just as a family, each family grouping, and write down on a piece of paper three things they liked about their family and one thing they'd like to change. And when the kids were too little to write, I went with them and the youth director went with them and we wrote it out for them. And then the families came back together just to talk to each other, nobody else, just talk to each other, and read their list. And then we met in a larger group and I asked the ones if they'd like to share what they heard. Time after time, parents said, we discovered our kids liked us better than we thought they did. We discovered some things that were really going great. But we also had some things said to us about change that we now are going to work on. Be willing to hear one another in that experience. The third thing, change negative behavior patterns when possible. When you highlight some things that are going wrong, then be willing not only to hear them, but to change. Research has pointed out that most of us are more aware of what our behavior does to the home than we are willing to change the behavior. To change is a requirement of growth at times. The fourth thing, develop ways to handle positive and negative feelings. You may say, well, I can handle those good positive ones all the time. What do you say back to your husband when he says, honey, that's a beautiful dress? Oh, it's just an old thing I had in the closet. Or can you say, thank you, I appreciate that you noticed. The experience of affirming positive feelings. Somehow our society is programmed to recognize negative things rather than positive things. And we need to look for the ways to handle positive affirmations along with negative ones. Then the next thing, to explore some methods of family enrichment. Find out where you can plug in on experiences that can help your family life grow. Do not feel by my going to that enrichment program, it means my marriage is a bad one. Simply take advantage of the opportunities that can be opened up to grow your marriage. And the last I mentioned, find new resources in your prayer life with each other. Invite God's forgiveness, invite God's grace, invite God's love to be part of your relationship to one another. Build your pattern firmly on your relationship to the Lord. Paul said, because of our reverence for Christ, we yield ourselves to one another. And so you have a challenge of being able to help your marriage grow. Yes, we do become models, like it or not, to people who see us. If our model is one that reflects a human awareness of each other, the honest appraisal of our strengths and weaknesses, the willingness to keep growing in love, the model may be very good. If our model is one in which they see fragility, in which they see the inability to cope, in which they see the struggle that doesn't seem to have resolution. We may not be modeling too well. We may be more muddling. But I would challenge you tonight to know that intimacy is a pearl of great price. And as you commit yourself, husband or wife, or friend to other friend, to helping it grow, it can happen. The interesting dynamic in most family experiences in a church is that when someone speaks on family, you stand at the door, the people come by, and almost universally they will say something like, "I'm glad my husband was here. He needed that. I'm glad my wife was here. I've been telling her that for a long time." But you know, the person God wants to deal with tonight is sitting in your seat. And as you commit yourself to the challenge of a growing intimacy, you may be the catalyst for it developing. To that, I encourage you.